The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management. The information and ideas presented on this show are for informational purposes only. Please consult a business continuity, security, or disaster recovery professional before implementing any plans or ideas discussed on this show. The implementation of any protocol is at the sole discretion and responsibility of our listeners.
Is your business ready for a disaster, or are you prepared for anything? No matter the industry or structure of your organization, chances are there could be room for improvement regarding your survival business practices. This is Fear is Negotiable, Business Survival Skills 101. Your host is Pamela Hill. Join us today as we study what's working in business preparedness and what's still left to do. Here is Pamela Hill.
Hello and welcome to the show. This is Pam Hill, your host, and this is Fear is Negotiable, Business Survival Skills 101. So today we're wrapping up our information security series, at least for this round. So far, we've covered the rules and regulations regarding information privacy and security, discussed key security practices at the desktop, in the data center, and on mobile devices, and discussed mitigating financial risk through cyber insurance. In this episode, we'll end the series with a bang by delving into the use of leading-edge technology that enables adherence to some of the more difficult aspects of regulatory compliance, access control, and monitoring. We're lucky to have today on the show Catherine Hume from Intapp, a technology risk management company providing, among other things, access control enforcement and data monitoring tools to address businesses' growing information security and compliance needs. Catherine is a member of Intapp's risk practice group and focuses on law firm information security and HIPAA compliance. She's authored numerous white papers and articles on these subjects and leads Intapp's Risk Roundtable program, an absolutely fantastic program, a seminar series bringing together law firm IT and risk leaders to discuss the latest risk management trends. Before joining Intapp, Catherine received a PhD in comparative literature from Stanford University, where she continues to teach ancient languages. She wrote her dissertation about the relationship between habit and knowledge during the scientific revolution and introduces her former research into her current pursuits to find new and creative ways to think through the central tension between innovation and regulation, which is something we all struggle with. So, welcome to the show, Catherine. It's great to have you. One thing I want to make clear, Intapp is the first technology provider that I've actually had on the show so far in the last 21 weeks, and there's a very specific reason for that. I get no compensation for saying this whatsoever, but I do want to say that I absolutely think your tools are the best, and if you're a law firm especially and you're not investigating Intapp tools, you need to be. And again, I get no compensation for saying that. I really, truly believe that. So let's get started, Catherine, because we have a lot to cover. This could be a three-hour show. So first, let's start by answering the $24,000 question. What are the key issues with regulatory compliance that technology can help us solve?
Yeah, I certainly would say it's a $24,000 question, considering the fact that it's a very large question that one could expound upon during 3 hours.
My favorite kind.
Exactly. So accepting the challenge, I'd say that the short answer is that organizations often think about technology in the wrong way, mostly because they're just too busy to really approach it strategically and holistically. We found that most of the IT and risk departments that we work with in law firms are so busy juggling multiple initiatives to satisfy different objectives, be it just keeping operations running, or trying to promote efficiency or even develop firm strategy, that they just don't have the time to approach compliance holistically and strategically. There's a few that have by now have the resources to have hired a dedicated chief compliance officer, but most of the time compliance for multiple regulations and with client audits ends up getting thrown into the bucket of IT, and IT has to find a way to juggle all of the competing requirements to meet the compliance requirements on time. So in the end, it ends up just turning into, unfortunately, a very quick set of actions taken at the last minute to check the box on what's required for an audit or for regulatory procedures, and is not set up to meet overall process and strategic objectives of the firm. But our take and the approach that we try to advise to firms is that for technology to really realize its potential to be effective, it shouldn't just be one discrete aspect of a program that is, you know, checked off and moved on from, but really incorporated holistically within the processes and procedures of the firm, as well as the daily routines and behaviors of the organization's employees. So to dive a little bit deeper into what I mean, the common trope that we hear in addressing compliance is that it comprises processes, people, and technologies. So on the process side, there's two types. There's the top-level management and governance philosophies that the firm might take, right? So a reflection upon the firm's overall risk tolerance, whether or not they're willing to perhaps address certain concerns using less than optimal solutions because the risks that that might entail won't actually be that bad. And as well as, you know, just deciding which departments are going to be responsible for compliance and how they're going to assign certain tasks. That's so much for top level. The rubber meets the road, practical and tactical processes are going to be the workflows that are designed to meet the various requirements. As an example, for HIPAA, this could be the specific workflows that the firm puts in place to manage incoming business associate agreements. For something like SOX, it may be the set of records management protocols that are established to protect the integrity of documents. The people category of this processes, people, and technology equation is basically the behaviors of the members of the organization, and often is reduced down to a one-time education program that's intended to spread awareness of requirements and modify behavior in some way. The common one that's very popular in the U.S. right now is going to be security training initiatives. And then technology is, I think it's currently undergoing a vast paradigm shift. So previously, information security tools available for compliance were sort of the fortress or moat model, right? So organizations invested in tools that were intended to protect from external threats like viruses or hackers that could compromise the firm's internal servers and networks and environments. So tools here would be antivirus software, firewalls, penetration testing, vulnerability, malware detection, et cetera. Once one was within the organization's walls, technology as it regards compliance didn't really play a big role. But information flows simply aren't what they used to be. Pam, you mentioned that, you know, in previous series you've talked about compliance with mobile devices and perhaps on the cloud. And now that information, the sort of the borders of the security walls are becoming more and more thin and no longer opaque, law firms and organizations at large are just forced to reassess how they're going to think through information security. So what we've seen is that businesses are moving from a external focused model to more of a content centric or business process focused model, where security is thought of as a holistic part of the data lifecycle and integrated into the way that people use information to carry out various business processes. And it's in this content centric, business process centric space where tools like access control management software and activity monitoring software start to really play a prominent role. The problem, of course, is that when one enters into the way the business works, this requires a change in behavior and culture, which opens up a whole new host of challenges.
Yeah, absolutely. It always does. And we're going to dig into some of these business processes in greater detail as we go through here, so you can give some specific examples. But let's start with, you know, possibly the toughest nut to crack, and that seems to be access control, which really is the bane of every CIO's life these days. No one wants to do it, but everybody has to. Let's talk about that one. What does that really mean to you?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, you know, my sort of basic definition would be that access controls are the policies and tools used to grant different individuals different rights to do different things with different types of information. So these policies can take many forms depending on the type of data in question. So in a law firm context, personnel, employee data, might be kept on a single system and only granted access by members of the HR department. The firm financial data could follow similar processes with access and editing rights restricted to members of the finance team, say. It gets trickier in the law firm context when firms are dealing with client and matter data because the levels of sensitivity for the different types of information that the firm processes differs based upon the work that they're carrying out. So that means that it's really hard for a firm to set up a universal client and matter access control policy because they have to assess the specific type of information that they're dealing with and then apportion access controls appropriately. So just to give an example and be more concrete here, if a firm is working on an extremely sensitive M&A deal for a top Fortune 500 client, it probably is only going to want to grant access to the four or five lawyers that are working on the matter. But if, on the other hand, it's in the process of working on high-volume real estate contracts or something like that, it would be more reasonable for them to grant wider access to a larger audience. So, in short, the reason that this has sort of become the bane of every CIO's existence is that it takes a lot of work to figure out how to set up the different schemas for the different needs. It takes work to classify the information. It takes work to apply access controls that people won't fight with, to convince lawyers that this is the right thing to do. And then it takes work to then, you know, operational overhead to administer this effectively.
So that's interesting. So you're saying that, you know, like in HR and in finance and some of the administrative departments, certainly with partner compensation, we're already, you know, sort of down the road with access control. For all intents and purposes, it's really on the practice side, you know, where the paradigm is everything is open unless, you know, specifically somebody is excluded. That's really where the head scratching seems to be. And I would imagine that's probably why everyone is wringing their hands and gnashing their teeth about this right now.
Yeah, I think that's right. And just for one example, as regards HIPAA compliance, HR departments have been on top of this for the past couple of years because they were classified as covered entities that had lots of compliance obligations a long time ago. And now just for the first time, law firms in their role as business associates, aka insofar as they process client and matter data, now have to think through addressing those compliance requirements. So it seems as if some of the departments have had a heads up because they've been forced to take action a lot earlier on in the game. And law firms traditionally, as it regards client and matter information, were unregulated given the fact that there were professional responsibility standards coming in through the ABA. So they, you know, the attorney-client privilege sort of took care of information security heretofore, but client expectations are changing, regulatory paradigms are changing, and law firms' behavior has to change in suite.
Exactly. Time to catch up. So we are going to go to a break, Catherine. When we come back, we're going to ask the other $24,000 question, and it may even be a $50,000 question, where do I start? So that's what we're going to ask when we come back on the other side of the break. This is Pam Hill. I'm here with the wonderful Catherine Hume from Intapp, and we'll be right back.
Be sure to friend us on Facebook. You can do it right now. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America or search for us at keyword Voice America.
From disasters to cyber threats, it's hard to keep up with the myriad of risks facing businesses today. Risk Partners Alliance is a consortium of business and technology consultants whose focus is to identify and mitigate threats to the operation of your business, your critical systems, infrastructure, and information security. We create comprehensive business continuity programs, including risk assessment, emergency preparedness, crisis management planning, technical disaster recovery, and information security services. We provide hands-on crisis leadership team evaluation and training through scenario-based practices. Our experts are widely sought-after speakers because of their passion, excellence, and unique training methods, and have a 30-year track record of providing risk management and recovery services to a variety of industries. Our proven plans have been put into action in every major disaster since 1989. Find us online at riskpa.com or email info@riskpa.com. You can also follow us on Twitter @FearIsNegotiable. You deserve some rest from worry. Contact us so we can help.
We're always talking business. Talk to an expert.
Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network. You are tuned in to Fear is Negotiable, Business Survival Skills 101. If you have a question or comment about the program, please send us an email to info@riskpa.com. Again, that's info@riskpa.com. Or follow us on Twitter at Fear is Negotiable. Now, back to the program.
Hey, everyone. Thank you, and welcome back to the show. I'm here with Catherine Hume, and we are talking about access control and technologies to help you with your compliance efforts. So, Catherine, we're back to the other big question, and then hopefully they'll get a little bit easier after this. This is the question I'm getting asked the most. Where do I start? I mean, how do I actually start implementing access control? And so I wanted to ask you this specifically because you guys are out there. You're working with loads and loads and loads of firms. So I'd really like to get some information about, you know, what are your clients doing? I'm really kind of curious.
Yeah, this is the first one was $24,000. This is the $48,000 question. The answer, of course, is that there's no silver bullet solution. It depends on the particularities of the firm, be it the firm's size, the extent to which the information is organized. We've seen a lot of firms that are actually still in the process of transitioning from a predominantly paper-based world to a digital-based world. And for such firms, the first step is going to be having a data governance program in process and in place so as to accurately classify and categorize data to begin a really full-fledged access control program. So size of the firm, preparedness to classify data in a digital format, overall risk preferences and attitudes, as I mentioned earlier on, an assessment of the amount of risk that they're willing to undertake, and I'll delve into what those implications are when I go into the various models. Number of matters the firm is processing, type of matters that the firm is processing, if there's a lot of really sensitive M&A information, that would require one model. If it's more high volume work, then a firm could probably suffice with a different type of technology. And then full-time employee availability to manage the program in the first place. So size of the firm, having the right people available to own and execute the program effectively, and then assessment of the type of matters that will require security. As a very, very first start, a lot of the document management systems that are available in firms do have native access control functionalities that a lot of firms can get away with using manually. There'll need to be somebody appointed to administer that, and eventually firms will likely reach a point where it will make sense to automate access controls using software like we provide here at Intapp.
Okay, and can you kind of dig into, you know, the various, role-based individuals, application of global rules, that kind of thing? Any more information you can give? Again, I think people are really struggling with this. Do we go back in time and grab all of our historic information? Do we just start from this going forward? Do we start at the practice level? What kind of advice do you have for people?
Sure. So we tend to think about things. There's a continuum of security models that firms can implement on their document management system and then holistically throughout the enterprise. But let's start on sort of a model thinking through how information can be secured using access controls on the document management system. So the traditional model in the past, as I described in the first section, is to have an entirely open by default model of access controls that grants lawyers and staff open access to all of those matters except those that have specific security controls on them. We think that this is a little bit risky for multiple reasons. The first is that there are insider threats. So typical example is going to be a disgruntled employee, perhaps a young, stressed out associate with limited career prospects given the pressures in the markets these days, who has access to information across the board and, in preparation for a lateral move, goes in and takes tons of information that they shouldn't have actually seen and puts the firm in an extremely risky position with a lot of liability. That said, most employees actually can be trusted. So the more pressing danger that we see nowadays for this open access model actually has to do with the sophistication of external threats. So hackers are more sophisticated than they ever were, and they therefore will likely have the ability to pass through some of the external controls that were set up to keep the servers protected. And once they're in the environment, they have free rein to take whatever it is that they want. So we like to use the analogy of a boat, which without if it didn't have any containment compartments within it, if one were to shoot a hole into the side of the boat and all the water would seep in, the boat would likely sink. So setting up some sort of restrictions that can work as containment pods will mitigate the nefarious effects of an external attack should it take place. So much for the risk of the open model. The closed model, on the other hand, where every single solitary piece of information that comes in has security controls applied to it, restricted, say, to those individuals who are working on a matter team, can be extremely cumbersome to manage operationally, hampers business processes, and tends to be the model that will cause the most concern for lawyers and staff not wanting to accept such stringent and draconian procedures. So this model is not advised unless the firm has a very strict hierarchical governance organizational structure whereby, you know, the decision made by the CEO or the risk leader could the CEO's or risk leader's word, let's say, would count to push it through the entire organization. So we instead, you know, pick the middle ground and recommend that firms go for a hybrid model, which is somewhere a mix between something completely open and completely closed. So then the next question is, okay, how do you think through the logic of setting up which controls should be put where in the model? And there's a couple of ways to approach this. Some firms limit information per practice group. So we've seen this really starting to gain momentum recently where there's going to be a baseline policy that says, you know, everybody's working on healthcare matters within the healthcare group has access to matters that might contain sensitive information. Central challenge here is that in practice, there's often a lot of cross-practice work that takes place where a tax lawyer is called in to do a little bit of work on a healthcare contract or, you know, whatever it may be. So setting baseline policies can be effective, but one needs to be aware of the potential exceptions that will require administrative attention. Other things that we've seen is firms apportioning much larger and sort of universal access to employees like secretaries, floating secretaries, or librarians, or administrators who don't process matters like lawyers do, insofar as they'll be working on particular matters for particular clients, but rather often need access to multiple matters in order to transfer records from place to place or just assist in the business that they tend to carry out. A third model that we've seen firms use is one of delegated administration, where as opposed to having a central administrator who's going to apportion these rules on a practice or a power user basis, they will delegate the control of access controls to the matter team leader such that as new associates are added to the matter or as the conditions of the work are changing, there is one person within the firm deeply integrated within the business process who, once given the adequate approval, can modify the access controls at will.
And that makes sense. That really needs to be an administrative person, quite frankly, because I could see this really being a fairly dynamic process, at the end of the day, and attorneys aren't going to do that. Right. So it really needs to be I wouldn't think at least. So it does need to be somebody who's really kind of familiar with the inner workings of a matter. So there's the open model, which is kind of the way that everyone works right now. Everything is open unless somebody's specifically excluded. Then there's the closed model, which you're really saying doesn't really work that well because that's just not the way that law firms really work, or probably even a lot of different kinds of businesses really work. So a hybrid model of really thinking through those power users the people that really need to have access to a lot of different kinds of matters, and then including the peripheral people, like, for instance, a different attorney in a different practice or something, or at minimum, having a process in place that you can add and delete users, those people that just come in for a minute into a matter and then leave. Is that a good summary of what you're really talking about here?
Yeah, I think that is a good summary, and that's more from the functional, you know, it's an activity-based approach to thinking through access controls.
Right.
They always will be dynamic. There's ways in which the adding and subtracting of people from matters can be automated. One that we've seen is that you can set up an integration between the time and billing system and the matter as it is housed within the document management system, such that every time a lawyer bills time to a particular matter, that will queue automatic access control entry onto the matter in question. But I did want to say that that's the functional oriented approach. The other way is a data classification oriented approach, I've had conversations with about 15 CIOs and chief security officers in the past year who are all undertaking a data classification exercise in their firms right now. So here, the hybridity would stem from classifying data as it enters into the firm based upon matter type and sensitivity level. And the schema that has been inherited from other paradigms, other business areas, is one that sort of works from highly confidential information, confidential information, internal information, or public information. So there, the exercise would be to find a way to either go through the existing firm data or perhaps tag data coming into the firm during new business intake as high-risk matters, once again, just to use the standard trope, like mergers and acquisitions for a Fortune 500 company, or matters that contain sensitive information like protected health information or personally identifiable information, which needs to be restricted down to that need-to-know closed model on the core systems and have affiliated processes like audit logs and notifications and acknowledgments. Confidential information might be those that are subject to a little bit of security or sensitive ethical walls and confidentiality policies, which might be restricted per practice group with exclusions that are required.
Right.
Internal information is going to be client information that, you know, it could be shared amongst the internal stakeholders, but you don't want it to leak out to the general public. And then public's going to be marketing information that can comfortably be set up on the firm's website and they don't have to worry about. So this is more of the, you know, not the functionally oriented model, but the classification model that firms are also using to think through how they're going to apportion the controls.
Okay, then we need to go to a break, Catherine. When we come back, let's start talking about taking an enterprise approach to this, because I think that that's one thing that I really want to hit on. I think it's important for firms to be thinking about that when they're selecting and implementing tools. So on the other side of the break, we're going to get to talking about an enterprise approach. This is Pam Hill. I'm here with Catherine Hume from Intapp, and we'll be right back.
Stay connected.
Sign up for our newsletter.
Go beyond your favorite Voice America shows. Visit iradioblog.com.
From disasters to cyber threats, it's hard to keep up with the myriad of risks facing businesses today. Risk Partners Alliance is a consortium of business and technology consultants whose focus is to identify and mitigate threats to the operation of your business, your critical systems, infrastructure, and information security. We create comprehensive business continuity programs, including risk assessment, emergency preparedness, crisis management planning, technical disaster recovery, and information security services. We provide hands-on crisis leadership team evaluation and training through scenario-based practices. Our experts are widely sought-after speakers because of their passion, excellence, and unique training methods, and have a 30-year track record of providing risk management and recovery services to a variety of industries. Our proven plans have been put into action in every major disaster since 1989. Find us online at riskpa.com or email info@riskpa.com. You can also follow us on Twitter @FearIsNegotiable. You deserve some rest from worry. Contact us so we can help. Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network. tuned in to Fear is Negotiable, Business Survival Skills 101. If you have a question or comment about the program, please send us an email to info@riskpa.com. Again, that's info@riskpa.com. Or follow us on Twitter at Fear is Negotiable. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Pam Hill. I'm here with Catherine Hume from Intapp, and we are talking about, we're going to start talking about the enterprise approach to the implementation of access control. So, Catherine, again, I know we're focusing a lot on access control, and honestly, it's because I think it's the thing that people are the most confused about. And one of the things that's a little bit disconcerting to me is that there's sort of the, I want to think about, you know, access control related to the practices, or I want to think about access control related to the departments like HR and accounting and records. And to my mind, that if you're really going to do this and you're going to do it right, it really needs to be stem to stern, a true enterprise approach. So at a minimum, I mean, where do you think, what processes should really be included in this effort if you want to be comprehensive?
Yeah, that's another great question. I think it dovetails with the approach that I was initially advocating to make sure that technology used for security is not just a discrete thing, but included in processes. And I think there's two ways to think about it. So one way is to approach it sequentially. So to think, how does information flow through the firm? Which department does it touches? Which systems does it move through? And how can one approach access controls along this flow of information? And so, you know, we think about that from a matter lifecycle perspective, saying that a matter starts in the business development, marketing, and research phase, which doesn't really involve access controls too highly, unless the firm were to engage in a beauty contest and end up taking in so much information about a potential client that ethical concerns become more delicate. So business development, followed by intake and conflicts, entry into the practice management system, entry into the document management system, time and billing time and billing, time entry and billing purposes, entry into records and through disposition. So the ideal in thinking about access control management would be not to secure each of these systems separately, but to tag the information with its given level of sensitivity the minute it enters into the firm and sort of have that tag follow the information as it moves from system to system and have the security controls be a part of this movement. Okay. Nice ideal, very, very difficult to execute given the fact that data architecture in law firms has traditionally been very siloed, right? So law firms didn't go into the ERP centralized platform vision of managing enterprise information, but rather have their siloed line of business systems with data organized pell-mell and often in very different fashions, such that having the same access control strategy follow the data from system to system would be a near impossibility. So the first step in enabling such an enterprise streamlined and sequential access control strategy would be to set up a data governance strategy where, you know, basically all of the different systems with their different security policies and approaches could talk to one another and interact. So how does one do that? Comes the next question. The core technology that would enable this is going to be some sort of integration technology. Traditionally, once again, law firms have sort of had ad hoc point-to-point integration projects that were set up to facilitate specific processes like syncing Active Directory with calendaring systems so as to manage appointments throughout the firms, or perhaps syncing the billing and practice management systems to have more control over accounting. It seems that the only approach that would really facilitate and enable an enterprise-wide access control management strategy is something called master data management. So what is this? It is a technique for setting up a central repository that's system agnostic that has the authoritative version of all of the client, matter, and employee data that's kept throughout the firm. So whereas the traditional model of integration is just going to be a point-to-point, let's make sure that these two things can reconcile with one another, this model will set up a centralized hub with various spokes to each of the systems controlling the authoritative version of each of the pieces of data in question. And then when it comes to then apportioning the overall enterprise strategy, one would use this centralized master data directory, if you will, to then spit out the right access controls per the classification scheme to each of the systems. So time and billing could be included to, say, generate alerts anytime a lawyer attempted to bill time to a matter from which he or she was restricted from a security policy. Records could be included to push the same security policies that are on the document management system down to the records management system. Conflicts could be included to filter any search results where lawyers perhaps shouldn't have insight into information per the policy that's been set up and is actively harnessed through that central system. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. That's exactly the core of what people have been asking me about. How do you really do this? And I think that you just gave people a model for actually doing this. But at the same time, it means that you can't do it haphazard. You really have to take that enterprise approach to this, start at the very beginning and work it all the way to the end of the file and the data disposition. So I think it's fantastic. And as far as the, some of the applications that you can do this with, this is an NTAP thing that you can do, right, with your products?
Yeah, so we, in coming out of one of our products, we have the first product that we developed is called Integration Builder, which was setting up those point-to-point integrations between systems historically. And we found during the past 5 years that a lot of the architectural models that firms are pursuing are these master data management models to get a better handle of where the data lies in the various systems so that they can use the data strategically to make better decisions about how to price matters and get better insights into the information assets of the firms and then, of course, execute compliance initiatives. So we developed something we call the legal information model, which is just a schema. It's a taxonomical schema for organizing client matter, employee, basically noun-based informations, not transaction-based informations, that firms typically use to give them a starting point to think about how they want to organize this information so that they can then effectively execute an access control management. Access control management is one of the policies and strategies that they might execute, but there's as many applications as there are processes within a law firm.
Really, really interesting stuff. And one other question. I'm curious about this. How have knowledge management initiatives helped or hindered the implementation of access control? Because it has to be a nightmare that law firm said, okay, we're going to make everything open so everybody can use everything. And now all of a sudden it's like, oh, just kidding, can't do that anymore because of security.
Yeah, so another great question. And I think as with the first answer where people tend to think about technology in the wrong way, people tend to think about the confusion and the contrast between knowledge management and access control restrictions in the wrong way as well. Naturally, there's a tension between the openness and collaboration that's required to classify information at will and develop, the portability that's required to make knowledge management function. But the irony is that we've had a couple of firms say that the most productive move that they've made for their knowledge management initiatives was to actually set up baseline access control policies. So not that full closed down need-to-know access model where information is really only going to be circulated between the couple of people that are working on the matter, but a more practice group-oriented or some sort of function-level oriented set of restrictions that can work as a filtering mechanism for the information assets of the firm at large, within which knowledge management can become more powerful, right? So if we think about, there's so much information in firms that they've inherited over the years, and it becomes this vast, messy ocean or a garden that hasn't been well tended, and to start to think about how to organize that and use it effectively is an absolute nightmare. And just like in any initiative, If the stakes are too large, it becomes absolutely impossible to actually act. So the first step is to break things down into small little pieces where one can make incremental and iterative progress that eventually leads to big gains, right? So all of this to say that deciding upon a baseline policy for who's going to see what based upon a particular business logic, and then executing micro knowledge management activity within that sphere can lead to really cool gains. So that's a that's a theoretical and general statement. On a very practical level, I can give you an example we've seen recently with a firm that's working to become HIPAA compliant. So the HIPAA is not about managing and protecting all of the information in matters that are coming from a covered entity, which is, you know, a healthcare provider or an insurance provider or the first tier of organizations that are subject to HIPAA regulations, but rather a particular type of data known as protected health information, which is individually identifiable information that could pick out a patient in their individuality and using this information, someone could do harm to that individual, which means that for the firm, it doesn't, the auditors and regulators don't care what the firm does with all of the general information in the matter. They care that the protected health information is protected. So one of our clients, in navigating this tension between knowledge management and compliance, decided to set up two separate confidentiality schemes. The matter folder that will hold the publicly accessible information, and the matter folder that will hold those parts of the matter containing the PHI. And then they're going to use different strategies, access control strategies, using our software on the public information, which is available for the healthcare practice at large, and I think actually the entire firm, and the specifically HIPAA-protected information. Which means that, this example could be, it's an example within HIPAA that could be applied to other regulatory paradigms where the firm siphons off that information that is most sensitive, applies access controls upon that information, given the criteria, and then leaves the other less sensitive information open for knowledge management initiatives.
So it's the same thing. You have to give thought to this. I think that there's this piece that, firms, especially who have so much information, are really trying to get away from this initial, this pushing the boulder up the hill kind of idea. But I don't see any way to get around it. But the good news is that once you get on the other side of it, it's going to make life a lot easier, I think, across the board for everyone. So, Catherine, I'm going to go to break just a little bit early because when we come back, we're going to talk about the $100,000 question. And that is how access control is really a paradigm shift. And how the heck do you actually get this going? This is the core of what you did your thesis on. And so I want to make sure we have time to talk about this. So this is Pam Hill, and I am here with Catherine Hume from Intapp. And when we come back from the break, we're going to be talking about how do we actually get this done in an organization. So we'll be right back.
Find out what's happening on the Voice America Talk Radio Network by keeping up with us on Twitter. You can find us at Voice America TRN.
From disasters to cyber threats, it's hard to keep up with the myriad of risks facing businesses today. Risk Partners Alliance is a consortium of business and technology consultants whose focus is to identify and mitigate threats to the operation of your business, your critical systems, infrastructure, and information security. We create comprehensive business continuity programs, including risk assessment, emergency preparedness, crisis management planning, technical disaster recovery, and information security services. We provide hands-on crisis leadership team evaluation and training through scenario-based practices. Our experts are widely sought-after speakers because of their passion, excellence, and unique training methods, and have a 30-year track record of providing risk management and recovery services to a variety of industries. Our proven plans have been put into action in every major disaster since 1989. Find us online at riskpa.com or email info@riskpa.com. You can also follow us on Twitter @FearIsNegotiable. You deserve some rest from worry. Contact us so we can help. We're always talking business.
Talk to an expert.
Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network. You are tuned in to Fear is Negotiable, Business Survival Skills 101. If you have a question or comment about the program, please send us an email to info@riskpa.com. Again, that's info@riskpa.com. Or follow us on Twitter @FearIsNegotiable. Now, back to the program.
Hey, welcome back to the show, everyone. This is Pam Hill. I'm here with Catherine Hume from Intapp, and we are still talking about access control because this, again, could be a three-hour conversation. So one of the things that, you know, again, this is the head scratcher for firms, and I think why people are waiting until, you know, 2 months before HIPAA compliance is absolutely required, that this isn't just a technology or a process or a policy even. It's really a fundamental shift in the way that first lawyers think about their data and allowing other people to see it, and this kind of concept of open, everything is open. It's just a really big paradigm shift. So how do businesses really implement lasting change when a change hits kind of at the core of a business?
Yeah, this is another excellent question, and I think it's the most theoretical and the most delicate to answer. So what I'm going to do is open a discussion and invite people in the audience that are listening to be in touch to push this further. This is something that's under development, but I think has a lot of power to be effective. So there's a book that came out a couple of years ago by an author named Charles Duhigg, who actually was invited to speak at Legal Tech in January, and it's called The Power of Habit. And the central thesis of this book is that we would love it if the world were governed by reason and people were able to think through reasonable policies, explain to stakeholders at an organization why these policies are reasonable, and then have execution happen overnight. People, unfortunately, are more than just rational beings, and it takes a lot more than that to institute a paradigm shift and really generate behavioral change. So in light of that, the first thing that I would say is that to really successfully implement and sustain an organizational change, CIOs have to acknowledge this reality, the reality that people don't always act rationally, and think through a behavioral paradox and then an organizational challenge. So this behavioral paradox is that the only way to execute a change is to sort of take a backdoor approach that's not ordering people to change their behavior overnight, or even getting them to rationally understand why it makes sense for them to do so, but rather thinking through the way that they act, each individual step that they take in their day-to-day work, and motivating and finding and keying into the emotions that drive them and make them want to come to work and make them want to push and want to strive and achieve, and situate compliance within this emotional framework. So Charles Duhigg suggests in his book that the best behavioral psychology entry point here is habit, and advises organizations to think about local routines that fit the structure of a habit loop set up in the form of cue, habit, reward. So the cue, there's going to be an event, something happens, it spurs a habitual action that can translate into a given reward. There's a Silicon Valley tech blogger named Nirial, who's a friend of mine, who's used the cue habit reward loops to think about people's addictions to Facebook, right? So the reward of anticipating a friendly contact is now achieved by starting with a cue, which is sort of logging onto your Facebook site. Actually, the cue is going to be receiving an email that says you might have a new update. The habit is going to be logging in and going through the motions of using the technology to get it, and the reward is that promise of friendship. So shifting this to the level of an organization, the key here would then be, you know, not to just set out some compliance program and go through the traditional gambit of things that people advise, namely designing policies and getting management buy-in and educating stakeholders, et cetera, but rather picking one or two foundational and local habits that can be modified to really generate change across the organization. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. The second thing I just want to mention as we go here that compounds the complexity in law firms is their organizational structure. So it's one thing if you're running a Fortune 500 company that has a very hierarchical order, CEO, the executive officers reporting to the CEO, the VPs reporting there, the directors reporting to the VPs, et cetera, right? So a typical hierarchy that can be used to execute organizational change because there's such a tight stream of command that something that's coming from the top can actually, hopefully, you know, with a little bit of work, make its way down to the bottom. In law firms, you know, the sort of cynical description is that every individual partner is acting as an independent monarchy. So the leverage that the risk association or the CIO or the IT department at large has to affect the behavior of the partners and associates that are working in the practices is very different than it would be in a corporate environment, which means that thinking about a paradigm shift from the perspective of individual behavior and individual motivations is all the more critical. Okay, big theoretical convoluted discourse. I thank people in the audience for humoring my academic background. So the question becomes,
my God, you got your money's worth out of that PhD.
So the question becomes practically, okay, great, habit sounds great. This is all nice in theory. What can we do in practice? I have a couple of ideas that I'd like to suggest. And as I mentioned, this is really open for debate, and I would love to continue this conversation. But three keystone habits that came to mind in my brainstorming for the session were, first, new business intake, right? So the name of the game, as we've described access controls throughout the show, has been to think about it holistically, aligned with business processes, and aligned with matters as they travel throughout the life cycle. If a firm is going to actually implement a data classification strategy going forward, intake is a great place to capture that data and minimize risk as well as operational overhead by automating the access controls right from the start, right from the get-go. So one habit that I was, you know, thinking about, and we all recognize and acknowledge that lawyers do everything in their power not to have to go through the tedious exercise of filling out intake forms, right? But what if the queue were the intake form? The habit to be executed was to actually put a little bit of thought into the security policies that will go around securing this matter, so as to instill that this is a paradigm shift and we're now going to approach matters this way. And the reward is that this is the only thing that you can do to be able to open your matter and start to bill time. So we know that the key thing that they're after is to get this matter open fast. That's your reward. But the condition and the habit that they're going to have to become accustomed to is actually filling out some of the security that's required during intake. One possibility. The second possibility I thought about would be acknowledgments. So acknowledgments of access control policies to get access to matters. The reward, let's see here. The queue is going to be they receive an email, some sort of notification saying, hi, we're about to open this matter. It's going to have the following policies. One could even, to implement a sustaining security training program, have a little second pop-up board that has some sort of security question, you know, something about malware or spear phishing or whatever it may be, so to keep this top of mind as they go to open their access to the matters. And then the reward being actually being able to work on it.
Versus training. And that right there is the key to how you really truly keep this stuff in front of people is on almost a day-to-day basis. That's a great idea.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking, you know, when I've had to do compliance, I can empathize with the lawyers greatly, right? When I've had to do compliance exercises that are just one time in my own company, you know, I go through the motions, I barely learn anything, and 5 minutes later, I've forgotten everything. I've now said that publicly, and I hope my HR director is not listening to the show. But,
your mind got full
that,
when you were at Stanford.
I mean, I believe fully that keeping it top of mind is crucial for actually generating those change. And then
that's
the third thing, Pam, that you and I are talking about is matter centricity, right? I'm not quite sure how to execute this as a habit, but affiliating the access control around a way of organizing the information such that it really promotes productivity and really helps the lawyers do their work would be a way to, you know, turn security into enablement as opposed to restriction and draconian overhead.
Yeah, and sometimes habit, let's face it, habit becomes a process once you've made it really easy for people to use whatever technology. Everything's in one spot, you know, becomes a dashboard for all the information that they want. It's cool, it's sexy looking, and it's something they can brag about at the next ABA meeting. I mean, to my mind, this is, you know, really how it's habit, you know, kind of begets all these other things, but you create habit by making something cool, sexy, and something they can brag about.
Yeah, that's right.
I hate to say it, but it's true. It's no different, from any type of organization, really, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, totally. And I think that, I mean, not even bragging about things at the ABA, but even retaining business in the first place. From what I've heard, client audits are becoming so commonplace across the industry that by this point, if firms don't have some sort of documented information security policies and proof that they are actually being executed effectively, they're going to lose business. So it's not only a matter of sort of esteem amidst colleagues, which is a super powerful motivator, but also the ability to gain and retain important client business going forward.
And I just had that conversation with the CIO just later last week, and we talked about that very thing. He's like, I've got a whole person that does nothing but respond to client audits right now, and that's why you have to have documented policies and processes, because then you can just hand that stuff over to people as opposed to having to respond, you know, every single time. So, Catherine, we don't have a lot of time left, and I want to make sure that people know how they can get a hold of you, and especially to how they can get on that risk roundtable, because that is fantastic. It's like a one-stop shopping center for everything risk related. So why don't you tell people quickly how they can get a hold of you?
Sure. So just also briefly, I'm not sure that I had a time to really go into the products that we make here at Intemp. So Pam had mentioned the our access control management and our auditing products. The access control management product is called Wall Builder. It's been in the industry for multiple years, won high industry esteems, and is used by a really significant percentage of those firms who are actually using software to carry out these projects. And then our newer product is called Activity Tracker, which is the pair in the security suite that focuses more on auditing and monitoring so as to verify compliance with policies that people have set up, as well as predictively find perhaps nefarious abnormal behavior that could signify a problem. So reach me at, my email address is Catherine, Katherine.Hume at intapp.com. Feel free to sign up for our law firm risk blog. There's about more than 1,000 subscribers, I think, by this point, really beloved in the industry, at lawfirmrisk.com. And then feel free to write to me. You can access information about the Risk Roundtable program on the blog or write to me personally. I am always eager to hear about what's on everybody's mind so as to set up the content and the speaker set for the program to meet issues that people are interested in learning about. Feel free to write to me with suggestions for speakers that you'd like to hear from. It's really a collaborative endeavor, and we're trying to work as best as we can to support sharing and collaboration between law firms across the industry and really develop a set of best practices for managing risk going forward.
Okay, well, thank you, Catherine, for your time. This is Fear is Negotiable, and remember that fear is negotiable, but only through planning, training, and preparation. There's no other way. So join us next week, and safe travels until then. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you for joining us this week for Fear is Negotiable, Business Survival Skills 101. We hope you'll tune in again next Tuesday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time for another edition with host Pamela Hill on the Voice America Business Channel. We'll identify more of the best practices in business survival then.